As you well know, there's both an epidemic of obesity and what's called type 2 diabetes around the world, including Australia. Type 2 diabetes being the failure of insulin to control your blood sugar. It can be treated with lifestyle, then medications, then going on to insulin itself, which is something that's not relished by patients and many GPs. But a study led by the University of Melbourne into what's happening with insulin prescribing in the United States may have relevance here in Australia. One of the authors is Philip Clark, who's Professor of Health Economics at Melbourne University School of Population and Global Health. Welcome to the Health Report, Philip, again.
Good evening, Norman.
So just tell us about this study you did in the United States. Now, we should really set the scene here. We're talking about what are called insulin analogs, which are further genetically engineered forms of insulin beyond the genetically engineered forms that are already on the market.
Yes, the study we've done really just tries to track the expenditure on all types of diabetes drugs using data from the United States. There is some comparable data in Australia, and we've done a little bit of work down that track, but focusing on the United States first, what we show is there's been a dramatic increase both in the use of insulin, mainly in people with type 2 diabetes. So there's always with type 1 diabetes, which is sort of early onset diabetes, these people have been insulin dependent and for the best part of the 20th century have been kept alive through the use of insulin. What has happened in the last 20 years is there's use of insulin and now use of these analogs insulins in people with type 2 diabetes to control blood sugars. Why do people use analogs? It's effectively analog insulin.
So again, people will still be confused. I should really just do a little bit of history here. So insulin was discovered in the 1920s. Found that it could save the lives of people with type 1 diabetes, which is the type you get when you're a kid and you're insulin dependent. The first forms of insulin came from animals, which had all sorts of problems with antibodies and control. And then the next form was genetically engineering bacteria to produce human forms of insulin. And now these analogs take that human insulin and further manipulate them genetically to get better, what they say is better performance.
So, yes, and you can either get what's called sort of rapid-acting insulins, and these are the insulins people take before having a meal, or you can get long-acting insulins, and again, that gives you a perhaps smoother profile. Now, there's potentially benefits with not having sort of low blood sugars, which people call hypos. Perhaps what hasn't really been done is any long-term study to see how that translates clinically into benefits over and above the existing sort of human insulins or the earlier generation of insulins.
And there was a World Health Organization report which said that really it's questionable just how much difference there is between these analogs and the older human insulins, and a Cochrane review, which looks at all the evidence, albeit a bit out of date now, suggests that there's not much difference either.
Yes, exactly. But what there is a difference in price. And in both countries and over time, what's tended to happen, particularly in the United States, has been a great increase even of the prices that people were paying, which are sometimes two and three times the price for an analog insulin, the price of a comparable sort of human insulin. And over time, the prices of the analog insulins, particularly in the United States, have gone up.
So, in other words, just give us a sense of what the dimensions are of that.
Well, in terms of, per person with diabetes, the study we did, what we did was we looked at the overall expenditure. Our average expenditure between 2002, it was around, per person with diabetes, around $231 a year on insulin in the United States, I must stress. That's now around $700, with about two-thirds of that due to the expenditure on these analog insulins. And that's largely due, the main factor driving that is a tripling effectively in the price per mil people are paying for insulin, which is due largely to this switch and also an increase in the price of these analogs.
Now, during this time, there's been a boom in medication. So anybody listening to us with type 2 diabetes, most of the people listening to us with type 2, if they have it, are on medication. Some of them are very cheap, like a drug called metformin, very effective. And then there's always been fancy new ones come on the market, and some controversial, some not. What's happened to medications while this has been going on?
In the United States, there has been increases in prices, not to the same degree of insulin. Insulin's outstripped, and now if you look at the total expenditure on insulin, it now outstrips in the United States all other diabetes medications combined, which it certainly didn't 10 years ago.
So your worry is cost versus the benefit?
Exactly. I mean, I think clearly here's an example of where the technologies have rapidly changed. It's been rapidly adopted clinically, and perhaps the evidence is really, there needs to be a time where the evidence needs to catch up, and people need to now make decisions where they take into account costs and benefits. And I must stress, this is much more a lecture towards people in the United States than in Australia, because we're actually doing that here through forums like the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory.
So what is the situation in Australia?
The situation in Australia is, I mean, is slightly different. We've clearly increased or widely used analog insulin, and there clearly has been substitution between human insulins, the older insulins, and these analogs. But what hasn't happened is the price hasn't increased. Having said that, interestingly,
there's still a differential, though. It's about double the price.
Yes, no, yeah, absolutely. So the price of analogs definitely are potentially 2 and 3 times the price of the human insulins here, but they haven't increased over time, like in the United States. Basically, once the price is listed on the pharmaceutical benefit scheme, that's the price that's effectively set, and it doesn't normally increase over time.
But what you're saying is there's still the potential for if you believe there's not that much differential in benefit, there is a potential for overprescribing of those forms of insulin.
Yes, potentially. And also, interestingly, if you take one of the analogs, and insulin glargine, which is one of the long-acting insulins, we pay about $400 for a normal, typical sort of prescribed dose, $400 or per month. And in New Zealand, they're comparable, exactly the same insulin. The New Zealand Pharmac is obtaining the drug for $90 or less. In fact, in both countries, what I would stress, and including in the United States, one of the difficulties is often the published price may not be the price governments are actually paying, because you also get what's called rebates to payers, which makes the I suppose it very murky. But unless people publish this data, we can't take it into account in our analyses.
So what you're saying is that our Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee might actually be getting a good deal, but we wouldn't know it because they're paying the $400 or whatever it is, so that the company can say that they're getting the list price, but in fact the company's giving a if you like, a backhander, but instead of to an individual, it's coming to the government.
Yes, and that's happening in all countries. I think it's problematic. I can understand why individual governments make these arrangements with pharmaceutical companies. Effectively, one might term it's a bit like trying to buy a car, and of course the car sales will say that this is the list price, but you'll be getting a good deal. That's exactly what pharmaceutical companies are doing, and as you perhaps well know, often it would be a much better market if we could actually compare across all sort of countries in the world as to what people are actually paying.
Just briefly, Philip, we go out to Canadian listeners via the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Do you know what the story is in Canada?
I think in North America, I haven't looked at Canada specifically, but generally their prices are pretty comparable for the many drugs under patent, because obviously these markets are fairly linked. But it's something I should look up.
So, to summarise, these are drugs that don't do you any harm, but they may not do extra benefit, and it's really a question for government as to whether or not they're getting value for money, and doctors and their susceptibility to pharmaceutical marketing.
Yes, exactly. And I suppose there's also, perhaps into the future, when now these drugs, the analogs are starting to go off patent, clearly there's potential for what's called biosimilars, which will introduce competition and should push down the price. And this is going to be a major sort of issue for governments and doctors in the very near future.
Because the history of biosimilars is that it doesn't push down the price, they charge pretty much what the market's giving.
Potentially, although they're here, I think there is some potential scope. But there clearly are players who are trying to register and have now got approval to put biosimilars, for example, for insulin glargine. And we'll see how much that increases competition.
Thanks very much, Philip. Thank you. Clark, Professor of Health Economics at the University of Melbourne School of Population and Global Health.